This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
That's right. Welcome back. This is Tech Talks here on WRFL. Thanks for keeping it locked all the way to the left here with me. It's been an interesting week so far in technology. I have an article. I'm trying to scour it back up right now. I seem to have lost the link to it, but it's certainly an interesting cybersecurity piece. So if we have the time for it, I'll come back around to that at the end. In the meantime, there's been a number of things happening that have been really interesting over the past week, and especially over the past couple of days. The first one that I wanted to bring up, one that I have found particularly interesting, is that about 2 days ago, Facebook announced that they were hatching a new scheme to defeat ad blockers. So you know there's this constantly ongoing battle here between a number of content users on the internet in combination with a number of content providers who are trying to provide some kind of service that is free to the end user while making enough money to pay themselves or to do whatever. And pretty much every large application at this point has some kind of free version to go along with a paid one. There's ads injected if you listen on Spotify or on Pandora when you're using the non-paid version. There's ads on Facebook and on Twitter and on Google and on pretty much any major content provider that exists. There's some kind of ad that goes along with it that helps them pay their bills. And so that's really where it gets tricky, is these ad blockers were born out of a combination of people being, one, tired of seeing these obnoxious, obtrusive ads, and two, as a method of protecting themselves from actually generally what can kind of be considered to be malicious content and malicious ads, which has, up until recently, been a much, much larger problem. So, reach into the past few years, in comes this new thing that everyone wants to agree to, content providers and those who are content consumers, I guess we could call ourselves, on the internet, and that is the acceptable ad policy. And this is one of the things that I've been a big proponent of since virtually the first day that I heard about it, because I have an understanding that a company, big or small, has to pay its bills and it needs to make money somehow if it's going to be on the internet and pay for that service space. But the trick there is that acceptable ads are built around a handful of big ideas. And those acceptable ads have really, I think it was five major tenets. And it's something that even the most major ad blocker has agreed to. So AdBlock Plus defines an acceptable ad as having a handful of things. One, ads that shall be treated as acceptable ads have to comply with the following. Placement. Ads should not disrupt the natural reading flow. They should be placed on top or to the side or below primary content. So if you're reading an article, that one is really going after the ads that are in the middle of an article, when you have to scroll past an ad to keep reading. Distinction is the second one. Ads should always be recognizable as ads and distinguishable from all other content. They shouldn't try to hide them or embed them or not label them as advertising. And that's particularly tricky. A lot of that has oversight when it comes to television or radio, but you really don't have that same kind of oversight on the internet, which is why they can get away with, and it has been for a long time, just kind of an any man's game when it comes to advertising. Size is the third criteria, that defining specific maximum sizes for ads, that they really shouldn't be taking up more than about 15 to 20% of the content on a screen. Any more than that, and it becomes too much, because at that point, when you have a whole screen full of ads, it really disrupts the flow, and it goes back to that idea of not interrupting the flow. And then they have more specific things about why ads should only have static images, and text should not be excessively colorful, and all of these things that everybody has just kind of come to agree are generally annoying in ads. Well, after coming out with the acceptable ads policy, and I believe this first came out back last year, there was a lot of discussion that revolved around acceptable ads. And this week, Facebook decided to kind of nip all of the ad aversion practices in the bud altogether. And what they did is they made they reworked the way that the ads integrate into the Facebook desktop application. And they claimed that these ads were virtually irremovable. They incorporated in a new way that the ads are placed so that they're theoretically indistinguishable from the way that normal content shows up, I guess you could say. So, which, based on the discussion that just happened there, it's pretty obvious that that's not in agreement with what an acceptable ad is. It should be distinctive, and it should be separate in some way from the rest of the content that's happening. But when Facebook elects not to do that, the AdBlock Plus community fought back against these unremovable ads. And certainly enough, this afternoon, the Facebook ads are back and removed, which is interesting. It's kind of an issue not unlike the Titanic. You claim that it's unsinkable, and that kind of arrogance is probably what gets you sunk in the end. It's Facebook claiming that they're going to make ads that are so embedded and so discreet that they cannot be deciphered from the normal things and removed, really just gave people the motivation to do so. And it's interesting, because here we see, and Facebook's a pretty big player. If they wanted to take on acceptable ads and they really, really wanted to make that a selling point, they have the power to do so. They really have the ability to get everyone, and I mean pretty much everyone, on board with what it means to have acceptable ads work out. And yet they elected not to do that. And I don't know, it just really makes me wonder. When you have Facebook, who has so much power over the kind of the feel of the internet overall. You know, it's by and far one of the most popular websites on the internet. They have the ability to take on acceptable ads and to make that part of their policy and to really, really help that culture grow. Because if the internet had started out as a place where all ads had been acceptable ads, I honestly don't think we'd have ad blockers. Because they wouldn't be intrusive, and they wouldn't be in the way, and they wouldn't be too large or flashy or annoying or anything, really. And it just kind of makes me wonder, can we ever achieve a point at which ads can be reintegrated? Or is everybody's default setting just to immediately try to block as many ads as they can? Even the acceptable ones. I mean, if we set policy on what it means to be acceptable and we let that creep back in, I think there's a lot of potential to kind of get back to kind of diffuse this arms race that we're in, because that's really what it's been for a while now. It's been an arms race. New inventive ways to try to insert ads that aren't easily identifiable and can't be removed programmatically, and then yet the blockers figure out another way to remove them, and it's an arms race. And so acceptable ads, I think, is the way out of that arms race. I'm going to take a break. I want to hear from you while I'm playing some music. Call in, talk to me. I'm curious, if all ads were acceptable ads, would you block them or would you let them be? Let me know, and we'll have some more chat. We'll have some more, as far as that goes, I'll follow up when I get back on here in a couple minutes. If you want to talk to me, that number, you can find me at 859-257-9735. That's 257-WRFL. You're tuned in here to Tech Talks on WRFL. I'm Grant, and I'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Keep it locked all the way to the left. We'll be coming around back to the Perseids, the meteor shower that's going to be hitting its peak actually tonight and tomorrow. So that'll be something to certainly watch out for. I'll come back around to that here in just a little bit. In the meantime, a little history side note I thought was kind of interesting is that Michael Phelps is currently tied for the most individual wins in the Olympics in history. I mean, like, in all of modern and Hellenistic history, all the way back to ancient Greece, the only other person to win 12 individual events was Leodonis of Rhodes. So Phelps is in pretty good company. He has 21 wins, 21 gold medals to his career, but 9 of those now have been in relays or non-solo events. So he has 12 solo wins, which puts him in a tie there, which puts him in a pretty interesting place. I think that should be quite a lot to look for as this week continues on, because that record that Leodonis of Rhodes set is over 2100 years old. That record was originally set in 146 BC, back when there were only a handful of racing events. The Staden, the Dialis, and the Hap were the three events that Leodonis won in 4 Olympics in a row. That's how he got all 12 of his wins, is he won the biggest 3 races, two of which are sprints and one of which is a little bit longer, the Hapalodromus, and the other two were much shorter, but kind of sprints. So, I mean, it was this kind of a big deal, though, to have achieved that. So I think that's really, really fascinating in my mind, and I'll be interested to see. If you're not familiar with any of the old Greek terms, the Staden sprint is about 200 meters, and the Dialis is 2 Stadens back-to-back, so it's about 400 meters or 500. And then I think the most interesting one of this group is the Hapalodromus, which is a 500-meter race, but you wear full military equipment while you do it. So you're running with a helmet on, you're carrying a shield, you have armor and greaves, all together weighing over 50 pounds. So it's like a sprint while wearing all of this equipment, which is absolutely ludicrous that's a racing event, much more about strength and stamina than about just flat-out speed. But I found that interesting. I hope you did too. Thanks for joining me here on the continuation of this episode of Tech Talks. This will just be a quick little segment, but I thought that was a fun little intro there with Michael Phelps. Something kind of interesting that I wanted to cover pretty quick this week was that there was a game that came out this week called No Man's Sky. And one of the fascinating things about No Man's Sky is that it's a procedurally generated game, which means that there was very, very little work that the programmers did in order to custom make a lot of the elements. A lot of it was designed. It's sort of like, rather than designing a handful of perhaps, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this, rather than presenting to someone a handful of already pre-designed, completely built models. Perhaps they're models of little toy models of cars or something like that. Rather than doing something like that, what they did is they gave the user a box full of Legos that they had designed, or any construction piece that you want to think of here is a fine example. But what happens is the game gets generated procedurally. So the game is designed to deliver somewhere on the factor of not 18 million or billion, not 18 trillion, but 18 quadrillion planets, each of which is being built and populated with its biome and the wildlife and the trees and all of that is in the landscape is all being designed procedurally, which means that they just came up with all the building blocks and did all the math and physics and then just kind of let this biology take over and create the universe for them. And it produces such fascinating results in my mind. It's such a mind-bogglingly large number, 18 quadrillion, that, I mean, it's hard to fathom what that even means. But I found it to be a very, very interesting experiment in that way, that it's so... I've never seen a game like this that's procedural in this kind of a way. And that's what's so fascinating about it, is that the universe is so big that characters really functionally won't interact with each other, even though they're all living in this same universe together and exploring the same universe together. It's so large that you may very well not run into anyone else, which is so unlike, so unlike a lot of other games. There have been a tremendous number of even space exploration games that honestly aren't hugely realistic in that sense, because there's just a handful of places to hang out at and everything else is just kind of blank, empty nothing. You don't want to go there. It's interesting to see a game in which you can truly travel in any direction for as long as you want, and you're never going to run out of stuff to explore. It's very true to the actual nature of the universe that you set up this set of rules, how stars work, how planets work, temperatures, species, aquatic, mammalian, plant life, and then you just kind of let it run and you see what happens. And that's why I'm so intrigued with it. But I just wanted to share that with you as we had a little bit of time here before the top of the hour. That said, it is just now 7 p.m., so thanks for tuning in with me. My name is Grant. I'll be with you here up until 8. You were tuned in here to Tech Talks on WRFL. And we'll be back in just a little.
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at WRFL.fm and, of course, via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to wrfl.fm/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.
Current time is 7:12, and you are tuned in here to WRFL Lexington. That last track that you just heard was by TTNG off their album Disappointment Island. It was called Empty. Then back before that, it was Beady Heart with Good Bunch and Rain by Future Generations. Welcome back. It's Tech Talks here on WRFL. You're just with me this week. My name is Grant. I'll be with you here for just a little bit longer, up until about 8 p.m., and then I'll be headed out. But be sure to keep it locked all the way to the left, because after this, it's going to be the Party Panda Power Hour, all the way up until 10. The Perseid meteor shower is going to be in full effect tonight and tomorrow night. And they're going to be averaging over 100 meteors per hour with peak times of up to 200, which is incredibly, incredibly high for a meteor shower. We're talking about at least two good events per minute that are going to be at least as bright as a star. So they're going to be very visible. They're going to be thoroughly throughout the sky. And it's really, really interesting to me how much of an impact this is having just on our atmosphere and how spectacular this is going to look. The effect this year is going to be up to double of what it normally is, and that's because of the planet of Jupiter. And so what's happening is Jupiter is slinging around the Perseid cluster, the group, the belt that usually hangs around, that we kind of run through. It's a large traveling pack of asteroids that are all... We see them about once a year, and this year they took a trip far enough out that they reached Jupiter, which then slung them back in more aggressively than they normally do. And the side effect of that is a very bright, aggressive meteor shower, which is going to look really, really spectacular. It's really, really interesting to me how bright the Perseids are, considering the meteors are actually fragments of a comet left behind as the comet travels around and around and around our solar system. It breaks off little chunks, little pieces and particles, and those are what get caught in our atmosphere and burn up in this really brilliant, bright way. And they're moving, and this is the part that really blows my mind, these little tiny chunks of rock, in some cases as small as a grain of sand, are visible to the naked eye because they're moving at 100,000 miles an hour. And they practically just evaporate because they catch on fire and just kind of explode in a flash of light. And that's what you're seeing, is you're seeing things as small as particles of sand that are just practically exploding when they hit the atmosphere. So it's really going to be a good show. You're going to be able to catch that here around town. You're going to be able to see it virtually all times of night, tonight and tomorrow. And if you want to watch with the group, it's going to be happening out tomorrow at Raven Run. That starts at 9 p.m. They're going to be watching the Perseids meteor shower out there. So if you want to watch with a group, you can do that. But I think it's going to be a pretty spectacular show. You don't need a telescope and you don't need binoculars, but they can certainly help for spotting one and getting a good look at it before it burns up. But that's just my personal suggestion there. You can go with or without telescopes, with or without meteorites, or with or without binoculars. You'll be able to see the meteorites fine. It's going to be a good dazzling show, so keep your eyes to the sky tonight and tomorrow night. It's going to be a really, really good... I mean, it's just, it's going to be a good show, and it always is. And that's, I think, why I'm so excited about it, is because it's just, it's such a fantastic thing to watch. And it's already probably the best meteor shower that happens every year. So the idea that it's going to be able to be this much more intense and this much more special this year is really, really fantastic. So, I'm very, very excited by that. In other security news, this week there was a breach of data at LinkedIn, which, honestly, now that I think about it, LinkedIn isn't something that I think about too often, but that's a gold mine of data. Realistically, you're asking people to deliver all of this information for you, to you. We're talking contact information, diploma information, work history, a tremendous amount of information on somebody. And so being able to, in mass, steal that data, on top of possibly getting away with some more sensitive, possibly some logins. They're still doing examinations to figure out exactly what they got away with. But there's a tremendous amount of information available just to the naked eye on LinkedIn. And now that I think about it, that's a pretty high profile target. So it certainly is. Certainly is a very high-profile hit. So watch out for your sensitive information there. Your email addresses, things like that may have gotten leaked as well, along with basically your entire resume. So now that people are able to associate current work histories and emails, also keep a watch out for spam and phishing happening, because that's also possible. Well, that's something to definitely keep in mind. So keep it locked all the way to the left. The current time here is 7:20, and you were tuned in to WRFL. Specifically, you're tuned into Tech Talks here on WRFL, and we'll be back in just a little bit. Current time is 7:37, and you were tuned in here to WRFL Lexington. It's between 6 and 8, so you know what that means. It's Tech Talks. Not sure that I have too many more articles for us today, but one thing that I did want to get to, I'm going to get to it here in just a minute, is about AMD's, the chip manufacturing company's, new plan of action that will probably be a lot of their driving force for the next couple years. They've realigned after not having a whole lot of success with ARM processors, but I'll get to that here in just a minute. Thanks for tuning in. The current time is 7:38. Let's see. You know what? I'll go ahead with this article, because we have time for it right now. AMD is returning to, after back and forth and back and forth, they are returning to the x86 processor style. x86 is a whole class of computer processors, also known as CPUs, which are backwards compatible with the original Intel 86 line, specifically with the Intel 8086. And so the x86 family is significant because if you bought a computer somewhere from, I don't even know exactly when x86 got started, but sometime between now all the way back to perhaps the 90s, at least the mid-90s, then you have an x86 family processor in there that will probably be either 32-bit or 64-bit, 32-bit being introduced in 1985 and the 64 one being introduced in 2003. So what's significant about that whole family is that for a long, long time, it's been the big driver of what you would see in large laptops, in large desktops, servers, especially older ones, always were x86, almost, unless you were building something for a custom purpose, a general purpose processor. It was just your CISC x86 family, you know? And so it's really significant that AMD, as the second largest chip manufacturer in the world, decided we're going to move away from the 86 family and start producing more ARMs. And ARM is a particular branch within the whole world of processors, and it's perhaps a good word for it is that it's specifically of a RISC design, which means that it has an entirely different architecture, and it's meant to be able to do everything complex that the original 86 could do, but better and with less transistors, which meant less resources and less energy. And AMD's had a lot of trouble with getting that to market and getting it to achieve like they would hope it would, which really just brings them to where they are now. They're struggling to get their ARM RISC machine processors going and to get them settled into this larger market and to compete with the already established server market. If you have a cell phone, particularly a more advanced smartphone, you probably have an ARM processor in that, again, because they're smaller and in general they use less transistors to do the same amount of instruction. So it means less heat, it means less power, it means less cost, and that's really, really desirable in smartphones and tablets. And they were trying to take that approach and scale it up to put it onto, you know, a larger desktop or server kind of application. It just really didn't pan out for them. So AMD is now moving back towards the x86 family, which I really can't say I'm too surprised by, but it's unfortunate that the more efficient ARM CPUs didn't work out for them. And I know this probably sounds like just a lot of mumbo, but the good news is that AMD is going to be able to right their ship, but the downside to that is that we're not seeing them continue to chase after this more efficient, less power-hungry, cooler, and theoretically in the future faster architecture style for their computers. But we'll just have to see. Maybe someone else will take up the gauntlet and really run with it. It's always really fascinating to see the ever swirling market that is the chip industry, because everyone's so competitive and honestly it's so cutthroat that it's constantly changing underneath you. With that, I'm going to take a break. I said take a break, but I think I'm going to be out We're just going to have some music to ride us out for the next 15 minutes. Then it'll be the Party Panda Power Hour, so be sure to tune in for that. I'm going to be heading out in just a few minutes. Thanks for joining me. This has been a fun episode of Tech Talks. I look forward to having Mitch back. I don't believe next week, but I'm certain that the week after he will be back. And so be sure to keep it locked all the way to the left. If you find any interesting articles throughout the week that you'd like to discuss with us, feel free to come find us over on our Facebook page. You can send links, or we can just shoot the breeze. That's over at facebook.com/WRFL Tech Talks. I'll be back in just a little bit. Keep it locked all the way to the left, here at your only alternative left, WRFL Lexington.